Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to T-Post, the online, where are we? The Executive Function Online Summit. I'm Seth Perler, Executive Function Coach out of Boulder, Colorado. And today I've got Peter Shankman here. And Peter Shankman, I was on Peter's podcast a while ago, which is called Faster Than Normal, where he decided to start this podcast, as far as I can see, Peter, to just be of service to the world and really share about what it's like to have ADHD and really perceive it as a strength. And I believe most, if not all, of the interviews are with adults with ADHD and how they, not all.
A good majority of them, but not all of them. We have a lot of kids. We've had a 13-year-old on the podcast last month who's already received like an Emmy. It's crazy.
Right on. Cool. So, and Peter wears a lot of hats professionally. But Peter, what do you want to teach us about today?
So my goal is to try to help kids and adults, but kids I want to help kids not have the same difficulties I had growing up. When I was a kid in the 70s and 80s in the New York City public schools, ADHD didn't exist. What existed was a sit down, you're disrupting the class disease. Neurodiversity was not a thing. Shit, diversity wasn't a thing back then. And it was a long road for me, and it was a hard road because I was amazing at the classes I was great at. I loved my English. I loved social studies. I loved all that. But hated math. Hated science. And not that I hated it, I just didn't understand it. And as such, my grades were barely there in those classes, but off the charts in the other classes. So I was always just too good enough to qualify for any resources. Right. And just at the point where I didn't fail out, but I was damn close. You know, add that to one of the key elements of ADHD or any neurodiversity is having the social acuity of a turnip until you really get a handle on this. And, you know, childhood was not a lot of fun. I mean, I wasn't beaten. I had great parents. I still do. They're wonderful people. But it was tough. It was really tough because I was different. And when you're growing up, what a lot of parents forget about their childhood is that there's one rule when you're a kid, and that's if you're different, that's wrong. And you know, as far as other kids know, and of course I want my child to be different, I understand it now, but it was a it was a tough situation growing up. And so understanding that and being able to sort of as I got older and realized, hey, this is what this is, and you know, this thing that I always thought was this curse is actually this gift that's allowed me to start and sell three companies for multi-million dollar exits. I travel all over the world. I've spoken to 94 of the Fortune 100. I've keynoted their sales conferences, their annual galas. You know, I've written 5 books, 4 of them are bestsellers. I'm incredibly lucky to be neurodiverse, to be ADHD. And I want to try to, I'm trying to tell that story. So I've written a book called Faster Than Normal, as well as the podcast. The book has blown up. And, that's its third printing already, I think. And it's the premise that, you know, ADHD can be a gift. And not only that, it could give you a tremendous amount of time, or your time back. It can make you the most productive in the world. You have to understand how to use it, though. And the basic premise is if you're driving a Honda, someone says, hey, you know what? I want you to have this Lamborghini. And you don't know how to drive it. Good luck. 5 seconds later, you're going to crash into a tree. So if you know how to drive it, you can be the fastest person in the world. And that it's taken me several years, many, many years, all my life almost, but I've learned how to drive my faster than normal brain. And that's what the story I'm trying to tell. And again, doing this, you're right, doing this to be of service. It's what's nice now is I'm being brought in by a lot of companies to talk about this as well. So it's a whole nother career for me, which is unexpected. But yeah, I started off because I wanted people to realize that different is good.
Yeah, it's so needed. We so need, like in the world that we live in, we need these neurodiverse brains to express, to self-actualize, so that our kids are going to be the people who are solving the problems in the future. And we can't keep them in these boxes. So what do you say to the parent who is listening and they're like, okay, Peter, so I'm worried. I want my kid to figure out how to drive their brain. But what do I do to make sure that I empower them to do that?
First thing you have to understand is, you know, your kid might be 5 years old and getting this diagnosis and it's freaking, you know, it's not what you want to hear, but a couple of things need to come to mind. The first thing is that the diagnosis is coming more than likely it started in school. And to this date, still, schools are not really tremendously adept. Public schools, even a lot of private schools, are not tremendously adept at handling neurodiverse brains, because your public school, and look, I was a public school kid in New York. I'm a huge supporter of public schools, and I'm a big fan of them. But teachers are teaching 30 children, 35 children in some cases. And if two of them have neurodiverse brains and the rest don't, it's just a numbers game. They can't, it's hard for them to teach the two and the 33 other kids. It's easier for the two to adapt to be like the 33 others. That's where the diagnosis usually comes from. That diagnosis usually winds them up at a psychologist or a psychiatrist's office and is usually a diagnosis of medication. I am not anti-med. I want to make that clear. I'm not anti-medication. I just don't necessarily think it should be the first line of defense, mm-hmm. right? We're putting five-year-olds on essentially amphetamines because in a lot of cases, because they're acting like they're five. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the right answer at first. For some, again, I have a prescription for Concerta. Maybe I take it two or three times a month. I take it when my assistant tells me, hey, if you don't get those expense reports in for your last month of travel, you're not getting paid. And I'm like, okay, no. And I know that's something I don't love doing and I need the extra energy to put. But I've learned ways and figured out ways that work for me and work for a lot of people, according to the response I'm getting, to get those same chemicals, control, that same concentration, that same focus without medication. And so the first thing I would say to parents is stop, take a deep breath. Your child is not broken. You don't have to move him to the island of misfit toys. Your child is freaking gifted. And you're going to learn how to use those gifts. And he or she's going to learn how to use those gifts. And it's going to change their life for the better.
Awesome. And I'm so with you on the medication. I'm not anti-med. I was for a while, but I'm not anymore. But I think we really need to be very, very intentional when we make that choice. And,
no question about it. And again, it's not the end all be all to be on medication. Medication, there are some very good medications for certain things.
It's a game changer for some people.
But you have to understand how and why, and is it necessary in this specific moment? You know, I am, if I do take a Concerta, I have to take it before 4 a.m. in the morning, or I'm not getting to bed that night, right? It is a powerful stimulant. And then the question is, I'm 47 years old. Do I want to be on stimulants, right? Can I get but that's the thing. I've learned to get my dopamine through other ways. I routinely get up at around 4:15 every morning, between 3:45 and 4:15. I have a Peloton bike. It sits right next to my bed. I'm on the bike for an hour and a half almost every day. On the days that I don't have my daughter, I'm outside running or swimming. But the days I do, which is most of the week, I am on that bike because that hour and a half will give me that chemical, those chemicals I need to allow me to get through my day and be awesome. You know, and sometimes if I'm keynoting a conference, I might land in Asia at, 8 p.m. on a Wednesday after 14 hours in the air. Get to the hotel by 10, I have an 8 a.m. keynote, I'll still get up at 5 a.m. because that dopamine is going to help me speak. It's going to help me be a better speaker. So a lot of it is knowing about yourself and learning what's beneficial to you and what you need to avoid as well. Let's not sugarcoat it. ADHD is a gift. All neurodiversity is a gift, but it's a gift. You remember, what was it, Gremlins? Right. Mm-hmm. If you had three rules, right? You couldn't, they didn't like bright light. You couldn't feed them after midnight and never put them in water, right? ADHD is sort of like Gremlins in that regard. And in the fact that you have these rules that have to go with your faster brain. If you don't understand how to use your faster brain and you do things like normal people do, there's a potential for downfall. And we see that all the time. I've seen it for myself. And I've put certain, I call them inalienable life rules into play that allow me to be the best.
I love that concept because I feel like a lot of the parents that I work with, they're coming from, okay, well, this worked for me when I was a kid, or this works for me now, so I think this should work for you. But what we're really trying to do is figure out who this kid is and what will work for them. And you speak to really routine and habits and how you've had to, sounds like very painfully, figure out what routines and habits work for you over time to optimize your brain. One of the things you do is you get up and you move your body, and other experts have spoken about how important exercise and movement is, but that's just one of the things you do. But speaking to routine, you've interviewed so many adults who have become successful, who didn't fall through the cracks somehow. Maybe it's because they were supported by other people. Maybe it's because they were just determined to figure it out. Maybe they got lucky in some ways. Who knows? But you speak to a lot of these adults. Are there some routines and habits that you have heard so many people say, you could just repeat it verbatim, that parents should hear because it's just so key if there are there a couple key routines that parents should know about that their kids should be moving towards?
Absolutely, no question about it. So a lot of what I've heard from these, from, and I'm talking about Tony Robbins, Keith Krotz, who founded DocuSign, Dave Neilman, who founded JetBlue, who else we have? Joe DeSena, who founded the Spartan Race, the band Shinedown, right? Top Grammy winning worldwide, you know, all these people, the CEO of Celebrity Cruise, Norwegian Cruise Lines. I mean, like huge, huge celebrities, CEOs, actors, actresses. It comes down to basically four rules, and unsurprisingly, they're the same four rules that I implemented in my life. And we seem to all share a combination or you know, some kind of similarities in all these rules. The first one is the concept of the elimination of choice. My closet in my bedroom has two sides to it, and it's labeled. The side on the left is labeled office/travel, and it's a t-shirt and jeans. And the side on the right is labeled speaking/TV, and it's a button-down shirts, jackets, and jeans. My vests, my sweaters, my suits, my nice shoes, those are all in my daughter's closet, at the back of my daughter's closet, because if I had to wake up every morning and go to the closet, what should I wear? I remember that sweater. Laura gave me that sweater. I wonder how she's doing. I should look her up. It's 3 hours later. I'm naked in the living room on Facebook, and I haven't left the house, right? So the key is figuring out ways to avoid the derailment of your incredibly fast brain. Again, understanding how to drive that Lamborghini at 180 miles an hour, you can't make left turns really sharp. It doesn't work. You'll crash into a tree. So elimination of choice is key. Exercise is just so freaking important. Those are the top two. Exercise, you know, I love data, and I've charted myself on every conceivable fashion from to like the cellular level. If I do not work out or break a sweat or do something to up my dopamine at least once a day, I have bad days. And, you know, it's no coincidence that I am a licensed skydiver, right? It's no coincidence that I did my first 5K 20 years ago and signed up for a marathon immediately after, and then an Ironman triathlon, which I've done. You know, there's something about, it is hardly any difference than being addicted to drugs or addicted to whatever. There's a high that you get, but I can do a skydive. I am my own gear. I have over 500 jumps. I'll do a skydive. I will land at the drop zone. I will go back to the airplane hangar, throw my stuff in the corner, pull out my laptop and write 10,000 words in 45 minutes, right? Because I am, and that's like my next, I'm going to go this weekend, and I'll do probably four or five jumps over the course of the day. In between each one, I'll write, and I will write my blog posts, emails, and newsletters for like the next 2 months, and all in one day. You know, so that elimination of choice and that exercise or dopamine achievable in whatever, dopamine, serotonin, and adrenaline, in whatever capacity you get it, however you get it, you know, whether it's exercise, whether it's skydiving, rock climbing, CrossFit, whatever, something that pushes your brain. You know, that thing called runner's high is in fact an actual high, right? I dated a neuroscientist back in 2007, 8 maybe, and she actually did she looked at my blood and she said, yeah, after you come down from a skydive, you're basically like a couple molecules away from being a cokehead, you know? And I imagine that's why cocaine must be so addictive. You know, from what people say is because it has that awesome, everything's great, let's just do this, right? And we don't get enough of that. So we do healthy things to get there. You have to know your limitations, I think is another rule. So I quit drinking a few years ago, not because I was getting drunk every night or, you know, going and driving drunk or missing meetings the next morning, or whatever. None of that ever happened. But, and I wouldn't drink every day. I would drink when it was in front of me. But, you know, you go to enough industry events, you go to enough whatever, there's always alcohol there. And most people who are neurodiverse have very, very fast brains that we don't have one drink. We have 8 drinks. Not because we're trying to get drunk, but because it's there. I drink water the same way I drink tequila, and that's not okay, right? I will chug a gallon of water. I will take a shot of tequila if it's in front of me. I joke that I have two speeds, and when you're neurodiverse, you pretty much only have two speeds. I have namaste. I have namaste, and I'll cut a bitch. And that's it. Right? There's no middle ground there. So one of the things I've learned about myself is I avoid situations where negative things can happen. And that's why I quit, because I don't have the ability to moderate. Most people with ADHD or with neurodiverse brains don't have the ability to moderate. If you look at people who are neurodiverse, one of the most scarcest things, one of the things that are almost non-existent in the neurodiversity world is the concept of leftover pizza, right? I order, you know, most people, normal brains, they're hungry, they get home from work, they're hungry, they don't want to cook. Okay, they order pizza. They have a couple of slices, they put the rest in the fridge for tomorrow. That's called leftover pizza. I've never had leftover pizza in my life, dude. That is not a thing, mm-hmm. right? I order a pizza, I eat the pizza.
Literally and metaphorically, yeah.
No, but yeah, and I need to be really aware of that because one pizza is going to lead to 2 days, you know, I'll eat a huge thing. I might have a couple of drinks. I wake up the next morning. Well, now I feel like crap. I'm not going to go to the gym today. Before I know it, it's a month later. Right. Mm-hmm. And I've just spiraled down without even realizing it. I had a trainer once who said, Peter, a cheat day is not supposed to last 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, he's right. So you eliminate the things and you remove the things from your life that can affect you. Then finally, last point, sleep is just so mandatory. Sleep and what you eat is so mandatory. I strive for 8 hours a night. So when my daughter goes to sleep around 8 p.m., I'm usually up by 8:30, 8:45, and I'm usually up around 4:30, 4:45. I get my 8 hours. It's made such a difference in my life. And I try to eat as healthy as possible. I find that the more carbs I eat, the fuzzier my brain gets, mm-hmm. the more protein and healthy fats and things like that I eat, the better I feel. And that's another thing is that, you know, we're putting five-year-olds on amphetamines when in actuality, how about we change their diets, which a study in Texas elementary school, they did this. The university took over an elementary school. They switched the kids' recess from 20 minutes a day to 60, and they changed the food from, like, I think it was 70% carbs to like 20% carbs, mostly protein. And instead, 46% reduction in ADHD in boys acting out, and 39% increase. Don't quote me on the numbers. The big increase in girls getting involved in the classroom, raising their hands and speaking. So, you know, let's look at those four things before we just say, hey, here's a med.
Awesome. That's so good. And I really want to follow up on the elimination of choice. I use that with my students all the time in all sorts of ways. I use it with myself. One of the things, I guess this is kind of an elimination of choice, but I'm very minimalist. And one of the first things I do when I start working with a family is we downsize and minimize, because the more stuff a kid has, the more stuff they have to manage. I want them to be able to manage a few things well and learn how to manage things in life rather than be overwhelmed and never know where to start. So elimination of choice is so nice. When I travel, I have very little with me.
I've broken up with people because they check luggage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I tried to never do that, except I did last time because they made me. But also the elimination of choice, like I don't keep sugar in the house because mm-hmm. I love it. Mm-hmm. And like you said, if I buy a pint of ice cream, I don't have half the pint of ice cream.
That's not
a thing. I eat it at 10 o'clock at night, and then at 11:30, I'm laying in bed with a stomach ache and wide awake and going, why did I eat that entire pint of ice cream? And so I don't keep it in the house. Now, yeah. I don't perfectly do it. I definitely, but
of course, but that's the thing. It's also okay to not do it all the time. I have been in a situation, you know, I had crappy eating, sitting on a couch one Saturday afternoon and doing nothing but eating two pints of Ben & Jerry's and watching The Office does not make you a bad person. It makes you human. And guess what? There are 7.6 billion of us. Come on in.
Yep.
And, right? And understand that. And you know, I hate this. Like, oh, you have to be on par 24 hours a day. Bullshit. No, live your life.
Yeah.
Try to do healthy stuff most of the time. And then once in a while, dude, go crazy. You think I live in New York City. It's required that I eat pizza. Literally a law. You think I'm gonna give that stuff up completely? No, I'm just very aware of when I do it. I set parameters, I set limits, and I go to town.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing, you know, you mentioned exercise, and I think that there's so much misconception about, like you said, an hour and a half, and that can be very intimidating for someone listening. But I've also heard you say something that I do, and that is you said that when you travel, tell me if I'm mixing you up with some, but I don't think I am. When you travel, one of the things you do is you'll wake up and you run the stairs.
If there's no gym. Yeah. If there's no gym, I'll run the stairs. You know, the thing about exercise, and this is the funny thing, you got to find something you love. Right, so I'm an 80s music junkie. I see you're a musician and as well. I'm an 80s music junkie, and I just love my 80s music. And so when I got my Peloton bike, one of the reasons it never feels like a workout is because there are probably 300 different 80s music classes with more being added all the time in time frames of 10 minutes to like an hour and a half. And so I'll put on some 80s music in the morning, and I will sing my ass off as I'm working out. And mind you, I'm like, I'm, you know, by the halfway through it, I'm I'm climbing a 10% grade hill and I'm singing one out of every 10 words, I'm out of breath, but it's so much fun. I don't consider that a workout, right? Like, that's not
exactly.
I have a plank. I bought this plank thing that is a board that sits on a ball, and you put your cell phone on the iPhone on the on it, and then you play the game on the iPhone that says, okay, you have to hit the kill these aliens, whatever. And you're doing this on the board. And I never used to be able to do a plank for more than a minute and a half. And I'm doing like 4 minute planks now because I'm constantly fighting and trying to beat my high score. You know, turning exercise into something fun. If people hear exercise, hour and a half, oh my God. I don't even see the time go by.
Yeah. And I do a lot of little hacks like that. Like I'll do the stairs up or down to my room at the hotel. Or mm-hmm. I was just in New York and I haven't been there for so long, but I come out of the train station. One of the things that I do is I carry my bag. I don't put it on the roller. I switch from arm to arm. I worry about my posture. And like, these are just little things where I'm like saying, how can I really be good to my body as I'm walking through a normal day? You know, how can I park at the back of the parking lot or little things? And I think for parents, you know, a lot of part of the problem, I think, with the teenagers is that there is so much temptation to be so sedentary with electronics. But that you can find your own hacks to figure out how to add more movement. It is just so important for the brain that the body moves a lot.
It is, you know, so I had Seth Godin on the podcast a couple of years ago. And one of the things he said, and it's always stuck with me, is that we've only been farming for something like 1,000 years.
10,000
years. And mm-hmm. prior to that, we were all running around chasing, you know, antelope and saber-toothed tigers trying to get food. And once farming happened, we could sit back. And our 10,000 years to our bodies is nothing. It's like, you know, it's like a couple of seconds. You can't adapt to anything in a couple of seconds. So we are still very much hunters. And to sit there all day and not – I read some study somewhere that said if we did two things, if we gave ourselves 30 minutes of motion a day, and if we drank 3 times the water we do per day as a country – we would eliminate 25 to 35% of medical costs in a year. That, I mean, what the? Come on, people! How freaking hard is that? Park at the back of the your parking lot and off at the office, for God's sake, if you're halfway there.
Yeah. So, why did you start the podcast? Why you have this busy, busy, busy life, and why does this matter to you?
Because I was very much about. After I sold my last company, Help a Reporter Out, I sat down and I tried to figure out why I could start and sell 3 companies in a row, do really well, but couldn't deal with long-term relationships, couldn't remember to take out the trash that I literally put in front of the door to my apartment before, you know, and why I had such low self-confidence, why I sold this company and you know, sold 3 companies and yet still think that every day is the day I'm going to wake up. The New York Times is going to have written this huge front page article about what a failure I am and how I'm all full of shit. And then when they don't do it, it's only because I'm obviously not important enough for the New York Times to even bother covering, right? And that all, you know, I have a great therapist. I've had her for 15 years. The guy looks like, for God's sake, why am I, Einstein. With the gray hair, everything, but he's wonderful. And I love the guy. And I've worked with them to try to figure this out. And a lot of what I figured out was it is very much ingrained in the childhood I had. And, you know, when your parents are telling you that you're awesome, but every single kid in school is telling you the complete opposite, you learn really quickly that your parents have to say that stuff. And it's not that I don't believe it. It's just that that doesn't mesh with the real world. And so that was, I didn't realize at the time how much that messed me up. And it took years of therapy to sort of unmess me up on that. I still believe I'm useless, whatever. But I wanted to see, I've had very good success, very, very much success in business and things like that. And I wanted to see if there was an easy way to be able to give back a little bit and send the elevator back down, but also in a way that, you know, there might be a 7-year-old who needs to hear this shit and needs to hear this stuff that I was dealing with all my life and understand that it's going to get better. And finally, I did it because I'm not a doctor. I was, you know, they say never meet your heroes. And I was really bummed to find out that several of the, people in this space who I trusted, who I read, you know, once I discovered ADHD and all that, are on Big Pharma payroll. And that really bummed me out, right? And I really was put off by that. And I said, well, crap, if the only people talking about this stuff are doctors and who are talking about it in a non-actual sense. Like they're very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Clinical.
Well, they're talking clinical sense, and they've never done it, so it's theoretical. I'm talking about theoretical sense in the respect that, well, you know, if you take this pill, you'll be more productive. Shit, I am more productive, right? I've done more by 8 a.m. than most people can do all day. Here's how I did it. I wanted to be that non-doctor who is able to say, look, I'm not a doctor, and I say that every single day. I'm not a doctor, but here's what's worked for me. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten when I say thousands upon thousands, I am not exaggerating. Thousands upon thousands of emails, calls, whatever, from people who come up to me after speech. Dude, I read your book. I started getting up earlier. I started going to the gym. Holy shit. Everything's, I'm having the best relationship with my wife. This is incredible. It's just the greatest feeling in the world, man. And yeah, it's just the greatest feeling in the world. And if I can do it, and you know, it's always nice to generate revenue, right? I like speaking to schools and things like that for free, and I'm going to keep doing that. And what I've realized is that businesses are starting to bring me in to speak to them, because there's a study that said 35% of employees and of customers in the next 10 years are going to be neuroatypical in some form or another. If you don't know how to market to them, if you don't know how to sell to them, if you don't know how to hire them and keep them comfortable, you're going to miss out, man. Because 35% of the country being neuroatypical, there's your creativity. Those are the people who are going to help you go to the next century and beyond. If you're not courting them and catering them, so I've talked to Indeed about this and tons of companies where they need to figure this out. And so that nice revenue stream is always another, you know, a new revenue stream is always a nice bonus.
Yeah. And I really feel like, so, you know, I didn't know that I had ADHD until my late 30s. And I'd been working with kids for many years at that point, but it was such a relief to know that and put the pieces together. But one of the things that I do, like on my blog and even in this conference, like I'm not in a professional studio, you know, but this is me, and I want, and look at your area, we're not wearing suits or anything. I want people who are the parents who are coming to this to see real people speaking from the heart about these things, because I feel like that's what we need to be sharing with people and what people need to be hearing.
And that's the other thing is that, you know, when you're 5 years old, and I have a 6 year old. And so I know for a fact that whenever I mention, okay, honey, we have to go to the doctor, even just for a checkup, a doctor is a bad thing. Yes, she knows they help people, but she only goes to the doctor when something's wrong or for a shot or, you know, a vaccination or whatever. And so when a 6 year old kid, a 5 year old kid, honey, you know, you're not like everyone else, so we're going to take you to the doctor. What the hell? Right? I mean, that's literally what we're telling them. And they already have this image of what a doctor is. Good luck getting that out of their brain. How about you're not like everyone else because your brain is faster. And you know how you play with your cars and the fastest car wins? You have that faster brain. So we're going to work on ways that you can use it and just be amazing. I mean, why aren't we saying that?
Why aren't we saying that?
You better be saying that. You work with kids.
I do, but why don't we culturally say that? I have my thoughts on that, but
I personally think, and again, I'm not a doctor, but I think for several reasons. I think number one, it's the orangutan theory. I talk about this in every book I've written. You put five orangutans into a room, and you put a ladder in. You put it in a cage, and you put a ladder in the cage, and the ladder goes up to the roof of the cage where there's a thing of bananas hanging from it, and you see what happens. And eventually one of the orangutans is going to notice the ladder and climb up and see the bananas and start stuffing his face. As soon as that happens, the zookeeper takes a fire hose and blasts the other four with ice cold water, right? And they're all like, what the hell? What, you know? And the one up there is like, ooh, ooh. The next day, zookeeper puts another five bananas out there. The first orangutan climbs up, gets them. Others are blasted with water again. After a few days, they start to realize they're being blasted with water because that guy's going up to get his bananas. So the next day, next time he puts the bananas up there, the orangutan starts to go. The other orangutans grab him, throw him off the ladder, beat the crap out of him, right? The next day, no one goes for the bananas, right? He's learned his lesson. No one gets hit with the hose. So fast forward, they start removing one orangutan and replacing it with a new orangutan. Now the new orangutan sees bananas. Awesome! Doesn't even make it the first step before the other orangutans beat the crap out of him, right? Fast forward, at this point, you've done this five times. You've replaced every single orangutan that's ever been hit with water, but every orangutan won't go up the ladder because they're afraid of getting the shit kicked out of them. And when they ask, when you ask, you know, but here's the thing, none of them have any idea why they're not allowed to go up the ladder. And so that brings it to my point. The reason that we're not talking about it this way is because, well, that's the way we've always done it.
Right.
Right? So we're looking at something that isn't that old, but we're treating it the same way we've been treating other things. You know what else was not that old? Leeches, right? You know, we used to put leeches on people to get out the bad blood 100 years ago, maybe, but we rethought that. And so that's one reason. I think another reason, again, I hate to say this, goes back to pharma's hold on anything neuro in any capacity or anything pain. You know, the greatest quote I ever heard was, if you have a headache, that doesn't mean you have an aspirin deficiency, right? And so if you have a different abled brain or a neurodiverse brain, that doesn't mean that you have to take medication to be like everyone else. Again, not anti-med, but it doesn't, maybe wouldn't it benefit all of us to look at this brain and say, hey, maybe we can do things that allow you to use this faster brain to your advantage. And I just, we're not doing that. And we're not doing that as much. We're starting to. And there has been movement and there has been progress. Specialized Bikes has a program that they've launched called Riding for Focus, where they give bikes to junior high school kids and put them on bikes. And the difference in their grades and their attention and everything is massive. It's a huge post. Riding for Focus. Check them out. They're, you know, so we're starting to do these things. Not quick enough to my liking, but then, hey, I'm ADHD. I want everything now.
That's, I love that you said that. And I think that those two things go hand in hand. Why are we doing it this way? Because we've always been doing it. So from generation to generation, we pass on these ideas and we don't know how to question them. But we don't want to question the story when we have giant industries that are profiting off of standardized testing, textbooks, pharma, curriculum manufacturers, these things that you would never think, oh, that's big business. But like Pearson, the testing company, is an $8 or $9 billion a year company. And what are they selling? Paper tests that mostly are graded by computers.
Exactly.
That is a great profit model. And it really is, like, it's incredible. And we don't really have those conversations. Like, it's, you know, the districts are determining what curriculum are bought and all these things. So anyhow, we have the, and we're not, so it's those two things that you said. We're not really questioning these old stories. We're just saying, oh, that's the way it's always been. And the influence of the, and I'm not saying they're bad or evil or anything. And they're probably mostly very well-intended people, but we need to be questioning this. For example, I don't believe in letter grades. I think they are morally wrong and ineffective. So you can have two kids with an A, one kid who has an A, the class was easy for them. They didn't learn anything. It was a blow off. Another kid worked their butt off for an A. You can have two kids with an F. One kid worked really hard. They have ADD. They always forget to turn stuff in. They got a bunch of zeros, even though they worked really hard. Another kid got an F for whatever reason. Like, what, the grades don't tell a story, but we don't even have that dialogue. We don't even say to teachers, would you guys like a better way? What way would you like to be, help, you know, evaluating kids to help them, to maximize how we serve them? We don't ask that question. We just year after year, oh, we do grades, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's A, B, C, D, F, and you have pluses and minuses, and it's on a 100-point scale. Like, we don't question the story. And it drives me nuts, because I think it is part of why so many kids are suffering unnecessarily, because it's very hard for us culturally to change the story.
No question about it. No question about it. And it becomes difficult the harder you the further down the road we go, right? And the problem with is that we're putting these kids on meds. They're on meds till they're 21. They're off or 25. They're off their parents' insurance after that. They have not learned skill number one on how to work their faster brain without meds. So now they don't have access to them anymore. Well, crap, what do they do now? Which is why we see an increase around that age in drinking, in illegal drugs, in crime, in whatever, you know, and it just doesn't have to be that way. You know, and again, not anti-med, but
it doesn't have to be that way.
But can we put meds in with a program? Can we use CBD CBT? DBT. Thank you. Right. DBT or cognitive or whatever. Can we use that in conjunction with that? One of my very close friends, a woman, a PsyD named Dr. Jennifer Hartstein. She's the Today Show's psychologist and all this stuff. And I got her first TV gig. And, you know, she and I are really close, and we argue about this all the time. And we agree on this all the time. We yell about this all the time, because, you know, you put these kids on meds, you give them no other training whatsoever. And the second they're off the meds, they haven't learned anything. You know, pills don't teach skills.
Mm-hmm. So what's one of the biggest myths that you find your listeners have or that parents would have about this type of thing?
So two myths. Number one is that when they hear it, the first thought is their kid is broken. And I'll repeat that as many times as need be. They're not broken. The second myth is that ADHD means that the kids can't focus. And just blanket statement, end of story, full stop. And that could not be further from the truth. The kids might not be able to focus on things they don't love. But you put that kid in a room with something he loves and you'll never see him again. They will do that for the rest of their natural born lives. And that is, you know, I love writing. I have written my past three of my five books, I've written entirely on airplanes to the point where I booked a flight to Tokyo to write my last marketing book. I didn't have to be in Tokyo. I wrote chapters 1 through 5 on the flight out, landed, I took a shower in the lounge in Tokyo, went through immigration, went back to immigration 30 seconds later, went back to the lounge, had an espresso, got back on the same plane, same seat 2 hours later, and wrote chapters 6 to 10 on the flight home to Newark. Landed at home with a best-selling book and 5 hours with Homeland Security, who didn't understand why I went to Asia for 30 minutes. But it works, right? And as you learn what works, that's where you have to start seeing the differences and teaching those differences. And you know, my parents, again, wonderful people, and they raised me according to what they believe was best. And one of those things was, don't listen to music while you're working. It's you're going to lose your concentration. Well, listening to music now is one of the greatest pleasures in my life. And it ups my concentration so very much. We have companies surrounding it, brain.fm, things like that. So, you know, we don't know everything. We're learning. Right. And so the key is to keep learning and keep exploring.
So as we start wrapping up, I have two sort of big picture questions to ask you. The first one is this. The second one's pretty quick, but the first one you can unpack a little bit. But what actions do you hope, you know, you've interviewed all these people who have these neurodiverse brains who don't fit in the box, who they could have fallen through the cracks and really not made it. And they were somehow able to harness their strengths, build a great life, contribute, what have you. What actions can parents take in the near future to help their kid that they're worried that their kid could be at a crossroad, that they want them to go down a path where their kid can have a happy and successful future? What actions can parents take to really support that?
I think one of the best things parents can do is to love their child. So on my 100th episode of my podcast, I had my parents on and I interviewed them and I asked them, you know, how come I was such a screw up and I made their lives hell. You know, I never got arrested, but I just always get in trouble for the stupidest shit. And I asked them, I'm like, what can you offer parents? You both having been through this, what can you offer parents who are unfortunate enough to have a child like me? And they laugh and they said that after they yelled at me for being self-deprecating, they said that we just never stopped loving you. And even when you were in trouble and even when we had to ground you, we never stopped loving you. We never stopped believing in you. And that's what parents need to understand. Their child's, you know, they're different. They're different doesn't mean broken. Different doesn't mean bad. Different simply means different. And you learn how to, you adapt to different and you make different better and make different work for you. Every single episode of Fast and Normal, whether we're talking to a 10-year-old kid or a 75-year-old person, every single episode talks about the common underlying theme of over close to 200 podcast episodes now is people who had differences and learned how to make them work for their advantage. End of story. We'll stop.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So good. So then my very last question, well, before I get there, is there anything before I get to my last question that you want to share? Any books, any thoughts, any ideas, concepts, models, anything that you really want parents to know?
Yeah. So, I mean, Fast and Normal is the book. It's available anywhere you buy books, Amazon, whatever. The only thing I'd really say is I'm at Peter Shankman on all of the socials and my email is peter@shankman.com. And I welcome people to reach out. Like I said, I've had a little bit of success and I feel that it's, you know, you have to really give that back. And so I answer all my own emails personally. I don't have right access to my calendar. My assistant took that away from me 10 years ago and that's in everyone's best interest, but I do answer all my own emails personally. And I welcome the opportunity to talk to anyone who might have a question or wants to chat about this.
And I noticed you have an interesting title for your assistant.
Yes, my assistant's Megan Walker. Her assistant is Megan Walker, or her title is Megan Walker, Calming Influence to Peter Shankman.
I like that. Cool. Okay. So the last question is this, Peter, from your heart, straight to the heart of the parent who's watching, who has a kiddo and they're really worried and they're concerned. What's the most important takeaway from your heart that you hope that they leave with right now?
You'll probably bleep me on this. Parents,
I won't.
your children are fucking awesome. And they are just, your tiny brains cannot comprehend the amount of incredible greatness that they are going to produce for themselves, for you, for this world, for the people they love. Don't give up on them. Keep loving them. Keep listening to them. Listen anytime they want to talk. Talk to them as much as possible. There are going to be some really hard days when they come home and they truly believe that they can't do anything right. And that's when they need you the most. And, you know, that's what my parents did. And I had a lot of hard days. And there were a lot of times when I wasn't sure if I'd ever get into college. In college, I wasn't sure if I'd ever graduate. I went to Boston University and I spent 4 years skating by the skin of my teeth because I did not do well in a class environment. I'm on the board of the school I graduated from now. So take that for what it's worth.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Peter Shankman. I really appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care, everybody. Go take some action and I'll see you in the next one.